I'm here on a job site with Tim, who owns his own electrical contracting business.
3 employees and 2 work trucks.
Tim traded up to Geico Commercial Auto Insurance. We're positively here where he needs us most.
They sure are.
With step-by-step help on all his insurance needs, all for shockingly low rates.
Shockingly low, huh?
Just a little bit of electrician humour. Do you get it?
I got it.
You know, it feels like we have a real connection. All right, I'll stop.
Get a commercial auto insurance quote today at geico.com and see how much you could save. It feels good to Geico.
Welcome back to The Deep Dive, where we crack open your sources, turn them over, shake them out, and hand you the synthesized knowledge you need. Today, we are undertaking a deep dive into an artist whose career, well, it almost defies simple categorization. It really thrives on contradiction. The American acting titan, Glenn Close.
It's definitely an essential deep dive if you're interested in the anatomy of a truly relentless career. I mean, 5 decades long. And when we look at the source material, the biography, the filmography, all the awards, and maybe more importantly, the near misses, you see an actress whose work holds records for both, well, monumental success and maybe surprisingly institutional rejection sometimes.
That contradiction of success is really the absolute core of our mission today, isn't it? If you just look at the trophies, you know, the ones on our shelf, you see a winner by pretty much any metric. 3 Primetime Emmy Awards, 3 Tony Awards, 3 Golden Globe Awards. She's essentially achieved the acting triple crown on stage and screen multiple times over. It's incredible.
It really is. And yet, if we pivot to the Academy Awards, that's where you find the defining tension, the thing people always talk about with her public narrative. Glenn Close holds a truly staggering 8 acting nominations, 4 for leading actress, 4 for supporting actress, without a single win. She currently shares the, let's call it an unwanted record for most unsuccessful acting nominations with the legendary Peter O'Toole. This paradox, this relentless artistic striving, without that final, you know, universally coveted validation, it's something we really need to understand.
Yeah, absolutely. So our mission is to excavate the source of that drive, that intensity. We want to go beyond just the iconic roles like, you know, Alex Forrest or Cruella de Vil, amazing as they are. We need to understand the foundational experiences that fueled her. From a privileged, yes, but deeply complicated childhood marked by a controversial religious movement she later called a cult, to her legacy as this versatile, intensely immersive performer who really pioneered the shift of high-caliber film talent to cable television and became such a crucial voice for mental health advocacy.
It's a fascinating journey, really. It links restriction with explosion, almost, where personal trauma seems to have been transmuted into professional power. We'll trace the path from, like, Greenwich society to the influence of a Congolese dictator, the restrictive world of the moral rearmament, and finally to her current status as one of Time's 100 most influential people. Let's unpack this foundational drive first.
Okay, so we absolutely have to start with her upbringing, because it's immediately clear that the person we see on screen with that immense gravity and intensity, she was shaped by circumstances far removed from the, let's say, typical Hollywood path. She was born Glenda Veronica Close in 1947 in Greenwich, Connecticut. Pretty affluent background. But that wealth apparently carried a peculiar kind of baggage for her.
It did, yeah. What's immediately telling about her character, I think, is her active decision early on to downplay this wealthy birthplace. She worried, and this is a quote from the source material, that if people knew she came from Greenwich, they might just dismiss her as a dilettante who didn't have to work. That fear, that need to be seen as a dedicated professional, not just someone coasting, it really set the tone for her relentless work ethic. You feel it throughout her career.
Right. And her family life itself was anything but conventional, even for upper-class standards at the time. Her father, Dr. William Taliaferro Close, was a renowned surgeon who spent years operating a clinic in, where was it, the Belgian Congo.
That's right, what was then the Belgian Congo. But the truly striking detail, the one that always jumps out, is his connection to power there. Dr. Close wasn't just, you know, practicing medicine. He became the personal physician to the notorious Congolese dictator Mobutu Sese Seko. Yeah, think about that contrast. She's a child of privilege, sure, but she's raised in this incredibly politicized, globally focused environment, steeped in the realities of post-colonial Africa, proximity to profound power, both good and, well, bad. That kind of experience gives you a worldview that is anything but sheltered.
Definitely not sheltered. Mm-hmm. And while they were in Congo, the Close family adopted a brother, Tambu Musoki. So the family unit itself was already highly unusual, dynamic, spanning cultures and political spheres. Mm-hmm. But the most profound influence on her formative years, the thing that really seems to have determined her personality and maybe her professional drive, was internal. It was this faith-based movement.
The moral rearmament, or MRA. Yeah. This is huge. For 15 years, starting when she was only 7 years old, her parents committed the entire family to this movement. And she has unequivocally in later years described it as a cult. This seems to be the foundational trauma that you see echoes of, or maybe the energy from, transmuted into her art later.
I think we need to linger on the details of that MRA experience for just a moment, because just saying cult maybe doesn't capture the sheer extent of the control involved. How pervasive was it in her daily life?
Oh, it was absolute. The material details that the MRA demanded, complete, literal commitment, it dictated every single aspect of her existence. What she could wear, what she's allowed to say, how she had to think about her future, everything. The family lived in these communal centers where the movement prioritized group goals way above individual identity or expression. So just imagine being a young, obviously creative mind trapped in an environment where genuine self-expression wasn't just discouraged, it was actively forbidden.
That is intensely restrictive,
yep.
Especially during those crucial developmental years from age 7 all the way to 22. It makes complete sense when you put it that way that she would later gravitate towards roles that are just volcanic, unpredictable, demanding total emotional immersion. The act of performing must have felt like a defiant act, a reclaiming of self.
That's the crucial insight, I think. Her desire to act, her absolute need for performance, it seems it became her survival mechanism. She finally broke away from the MRA at age 22, and she explicitly credited her lifelong ambition to be an actress with giving her the internal strength, the sort of permission she needed to walk away and, in her words, save herself. She spoke later about the terrible effects on their kids, even while, interestingly, forgiving her parents for their commitment to the cause itself.
It really sets up the narrative for her entire career, doesn't it? That quest for emotional freedom through intensity. Art became the antidote to constraint.
Exactly. And once she broke free, she attacked her education with that same almost ferocious intensity. She'd already traveled globally with the nonprofit singing group Up With People in the mid to late 60s. She even founded a small offshoot called the Green Glen Singers. But then she pivoted sharply to academic rigor at the College of William and Mary.
Right, where she double majored in theater and anthropology.
Mm.
And she didn't just attend, she excelled, earned election to the Honor Society, Phi Beta Kappa. So the drive wasn't purely creative, it was intellectual, too.
Mm-hmm. And the serious professional focus really gelled, apparently, during her senior year after watching an interview with the legendary Katharine Hepburn on The Dick Cavett Show. That was the moment of crystallization for her, when she realized the potential and the seriousness of acting as a craft. She trained under Howard Scammon there, immersing herself completely in the theatrical groundwork.
And here's a really beautiful detail showing that long-term loyalty. Despite all her later Hollywood fame, she's kept incredibly strong ties to William and Mary. She goes back regularly to lecture, and just in 2023, she served as the Grand Marshal for Homecoming. And even more importantly, the main stage of the renovated Phi Beta Kappa Memorial Hall was named the Glenn Close Theater in her honor. That initial training ground literally became her landmark.
It really demonstrates that the foundation, the hard work, the academic pursuit of the craft, that's where her heart truly lies, perhaps even more than the, you know, the glitz of Hollywood. And that foundation would serve her incredibly well when her career finally exploded.
Okay, so having established that intense foundation, her professional journey begins relatively late for a major screen star. She was 27 in 1974, and she didn't jump straight into movies. She started where she was trained to stage.
Correct. She made her professional stage and Broadway debut that year in Love for Love. The 1970s were really spent honing her craft, doing works like the short-lived musical Rex in 76, just accumulating the discipline and versatility of a working stage actor. But the performance that truly got Hollywood's attention came right at the turn of the decade.
That was playing Cherry in the musical Barnum, right?
Yeah.
From 1980 to 81. That earned her her first Tony nomination.
Exactly. That's where the world really started to see her potential. And it was director George Roy Hill who discovered her on Broadway there and offered her an audition that led to her first ever film role.
And that first film role wasn't some small part, was it? It was a starring role that immediately catapulted her into, like, the highest echelon of Hollywood recognition. Playing Jenny Fields, the feminist nurturing mother of Robin Williams' character in The World, according to Garp. 1982.
Mm-hmm. And the casting itself tells you so much about her immediate gravitas. She was only 4 years older than Robin Williams, but completely believable as his mother. That performance, rooted in kindness and this quiet strength, earned her the first of her 8 total Oscar nominations, this one for supporting actress.
Wow, an incredible debut. But what's even more shocking, maybe, is the streak that immediately followed. It shows a pace and versatility that few actors achieve over an entire lifetime, let alone in their first 3 years of film work.
Totally. Her immediate follow-up was The Big Chill in 1983, where she played Sarah Cooper. And that was a role Lawrence Kasdan specifically wrote for her. That earned her a second consecutive Oscar nomination, again for supporting actress. But the really impressive recognition came after The Big Chill wrapped.
What was that?
She became only the third actor in history. I mean, the list is longer now, but it was incredibly exclusive back then to receive a Tony, an Emmy, and an Oscar nomination all in the same calendar year.
Yeah. All three in 1 year.
All three. That is just a breathtaking feat of cross-platform dominance. It confirmed that her intensity, her skill, it translated perfectly across every medium.
And the streak just kept going. She earned a third consecutive supporting actress nomination for a relatively small but deeply memorable role in Robert Redford's baseball drama The Natural in 1984. How do you even explain that, that rapid back-to-back-to-back success, especially for roles that were often supporting?
Well, it speaks to her meticulous approach to the craft, even in smaller parts. She has this fantastic anecdote about The Natural that shows she understood cinema, not just acting, right from the start. She actually credits that nomination largely to the cinematographer, Caleb Deschanel. She said the nomination was really earned by the lighting and the lens work.
Really? How so? That's fascinating.
Yeah. She explained that the iconic moment, you know, the one where she's watching Robert Redford's character from the stands, it was meticulously planned. Her hat was specifically designed so the sunlight would filter through it. They waited for the perfect time of day with the sun shining through the back of the stadium. And Deschanel used a specific lens that deliberately muted the people around her, making sure she stood out as the absolute focal point. She summarized it like, "It was an incredibly well thought out shot, and I honestly think that's the reason I got nominated."
That demonstrates such an awareness of the visual architecture of cinema. It elevates her beyond just being a stage actor who happened to cross over. She got it.
That's incredible insight. And beyond the screen nominations, 1984 also marked a crucial win for her. She took home her first Tony Award for the play The Real Thing, directed by the great Mike Nichols. So she was validating her career success on the stage while simultaneously setting nomination records in Hollywood. Busy year. Extremely busy. And if we connect this back to her drive, this accumulation of accolades for playing these fundamentally kind, nurturing, sympathetic women, Jenny Fields in Garp, Sarah Cooper in The Big Chill, well, it was starting to feel like a trap to her. She realized she was at risk of being typecast as the perpetually supportive wife or mother figure. Our sources indicate this is the exact moment she actively began seeking roles that were different. Roles that were darker, more complex, sometimes outright villainous, specifically to avoid getting stuck in that comfortable box.
And thank goodness she did, because that intentional pivot led directly to the era that would define her global stardom.
Yeah, the shift didn't happen overnight, though, and it required some real professional grit on her part. She first took a step in this new direction with the legal thriller Jagged Edge in 1985. She actually replaced Jane Fonda in that role.
And she had to overcome some pretty stunning resistance from the production side, didn't she? I read the producer, Martin Ranzehoff, was famously resistant to casting her. He reportedly called her too ugly for the part.
That's the story, yeah. Horrendous. But it's a powerful moment in her early film career, how she handled it. Close used her burgeoning industry clout. She refused to allow that producer on set during her scenes, insisted on the necessary creative space, and the director, Richard Marquand, stood firm behind her. The studio ultimately realized the power of her performance and backed her up. That refusal to yield to superficial judgment, it feels like the same tenacity that let her walk away from the MRA years earlier. She just wasn't going to be told who she was allowed to be.
Absolutely. And that grit, that standing her ground, it paved the way for the role that would permanently etch her image into cinematic history. Alex Forrest in the psychological thriller Fatal Attraction, 1987.
Fatal Attraction. I mean, it wasn't just a hit. It was a massive cultural nerve strike. It became the highest grossing film worldwide that year. It generated immense public discussion about fidelity, revenge, obsession, everything. This film launched Close into the absolute stratosphere of international stardom.
And her portrayal of Alex Forrest is just one of the all-time great villain performances. It was so potent, so pervasive, that the phrase bunny boiler, you know, derived from that particularly disturbing scene, it was actually added to the dictionary as a descriptor for a vengeful or psychotic woman. That's cultural impact right there.
That's huge impact. And the sheer depth of preparation she brought to the role is remarkable, especially considering her background. She later said she did more prep for Fatal Attraction than any prior role because it was the first time she was truly allowed to embody something that contradicted her previously perceived screen persona. The intensity required was absolute.
And here's where the high-stakes drama of the performance literally connected to her personal life in a pretty shocking way. The original ending of the film was reshot, right? And during one of the takes, where Alex Forrest is struggling violently, Close actually suffered a concussion from smashing her head against a mirror.
That's right. And when she was rushed to the hospital for treatment, they discovered she was a few weeks pregnant with her daughter, Annie Stark.
Wow. Talk about life imitating art. Or maybe art impacting life.
It's a truly visceral anecdote. It links the emotional violence required for the role with the very beginning of her life as a mother. That deeply committed, almost physically sacrificial performance earned her her fourth Oscar nomination and, significantly, her first in the leading actress category. It confirmed the audience and the industry were absolutely willing to follow her to the dark side.
And she didn't slow down at all. The very next year, 1988, she returned to high-class villainy as the supremely intelligent and scheming aristocrat, the Marquise de Merteuil, in Dangerous Liaisons.
Yes, and this performance was a masterclass in controlled intellectual malice, a completely different gear from the explosive rage of Alex Forrest. She garnered stellar reviews, earned her fifth Oscar nomination, and her first BAFTA nomination, too. She had successfully transitioned from playing the good woman to mastering the magnificent antagonist.
Speaking of magnificent antagonists,
yeah.
She fully embraced the camp, high-fashion menace of Cruella de Vil in the live-action 101 Dalmatians in 96, and then the sequel.
Trust and Will is an online estate planning service. Visit trustandwill.com for details.
Ooh, Trust and Will.
My dad and I were always close, but some things we just didn't talk about, like his will. After he was gone, we found out he didn't have one, and it created a lot of stress during a time of grief.
Creating a will can be hard to think about, but avoiding it can lead to greater difficulty for the people you love. That's why Trust and Will makes estate planning simple. Create a will online in as little as 30 minutes.
Now, I have a will in place to make sure my loved ones are protected. With Trust and Will, it was easy and affordable, and I got peace of mind knowing my wishes are clear.
Trust and Will!
Get 20% off when you visit trustandwill.com/future. That's trustandwill.com/future to get 20% off. Trustandwill.com/future.
Full in 2000.
Yeah.
This was pure blockbuster stardom, proving her intensity could also be fun and flamboyant.
Totally. And that role earned her a Golden Globe nomination for Best Actress in a Comedy or Musical. And here's one of my favorite details about her dedication to the artistic process and its preservation. She has this unique contract clause. It allowed her to keep all of her costumes from her films.
All of them. And not copies either, right? The sources say when producers suggested using copies for Cruella because the materials were so expensive and elaborate, she rejected the idea. She insisted on keeping the originals.
That's right, originals only. And this wasn't just about personal hoarding. In 2017, she donated that entire vast collection. It's like a veritable archive of her career expressed through fabric and design to Indiana University Bloomington. It just speaks volumes about her profound respect for costuming as an integral part of the character, a memory keeper for the performance itself.
That's amazing. And while her film work was soaring, she maintained her undeniable dominance on the stage. In 1995, she took on the role that many consider her crowning theatrical achievement, Norma Desmond in Andrew Lloyd Webber's Sunset Boulevard.
Oh, absolutely. She won her third Tony Award for that performance, Best Actress in a Musical. And the critical reaction was just unanimous praise. David Richards of the New York Times called it one of those legendary performances people will be talking about years from now.
Yep.
It cemented her not just as a film star, but as a living legend of the stage, period.
And she proved the enduring nature of that legend by reprising the role decades later. First on the West End in 2016, and then back on Broadway in 2017. That return run was apparently spectacular, featuring a full 40-piece orchestra, which was the largest orchestra in Broadway history at the time.
That return was such a profound artistic statement. It demonstrated that she could still command the largest theatrical platform available, blending that intensity of her film stardom with the discipline of her theatrical roots decades later. And she continued to balance this gravity with mainstream success, too. Famously playing the trustworthy vice president in Air Force One in 1997.
That's another fascinating casting story, isn't it? Harrison Ford personally chose Close for the role, which was originally written for a man. They met at a birthday party for President Bill Clinton, apparently.
That level of personal recommendation from a star like Ford, it just speaks volumes about the respect she commanded across the entire industry.
Okay, so as we move into the 2000s, Close makes a pivot that, looking back now, was truly industry-defining. At a time when major film stars rarely, if ever, kind of downgraded to the small screen, she moved deliberately to cable television.
Yeah, this move was genuinely seismic at the time. In 2005, she joined the FX crime series The Shield as Captain Monica Rawling. It sounds almost commonplace now, but we have to understand the timing. This was before streaming giants dominated everything, before the phrase peak TV was even a thing, film actors going to cable, especially of her stature. It was a rare and significant statement.
Right. So what was the significance of her presence on The Shield specifically? Why was it such a watershed moment?
Well, the CEO of FX, John Landgraf, actually provided the clearest answer later on. He publicly stated that Close's presence was pivotal. He credited FX with being the first to bring a female movie star of Glenn Close's stature to television. Her move immediately signaled that complex, high-quality drama was migrating to cable. It helped promote better roles for women in the process, and it definitely encouraged other film actors to follow suit. She essentially gave permission, in a way, for the entire golden era of cable and prestige television to really take off.
Wow. So she wasn't just a participant. She was a pioneer who actively elevated the entire medium's reputation. But her most famous and probably defining TV role came next. The ruthless, brilliant, morally ambiguous lawyer, Patty Hughes.
On Damages, which ran from 2007 to 2012, Close herself called this the role of her life. And she just captured the icy calculation of Hughes perfectly, balancing vulnerability with this sheer, terrifying strategic brilliance. This role earned her back-to-back Emmy Awards for Outstanding Lead Actress in a Drama Series, proving her dominance in this new medium, too.
And her market value reflected that dominance. She became one of the highest-paid actresses on cable at the time, reportedly earning something like $200,000 per episode.
That's the figure, yeah. $200,000 an episode. She proved that the quality and complexity of her work commanded top dollar, regardless of whether it's on the big screen or the small screen.
But despite this massive television success, her passion for challenging big screen projects clearly never waned. The ultimate example of her resilience and commitment as a producer slash star has to be Albert Nobbs, right? From 2011.
Oh, absolutely. Albert Nobbs. This wasn't just another film role for her. This was a personal crusade, something she nurtured for 2 decades. 20 years. She co-wrote it, she produced it, and she starred in it, playing a woman in 19th century Ireland who lives and works as a man. That level of dedication, 2 decades of effort to get a story told, it's truly extraordinary.
It really speaks directly to her artistic purpose, doesn't it?
Yeah.
She stated that the film was deeply important to her to stimulate discussion on transgender issues. And this was long before these discussions were as mainstream as they are now. And the performance itself was lauded precisely for its subtlety, its introversion, such a stark contrast to the explosive nature of an Alex Forrest or a Cruella. It really demonstrated her immense range yet again.
Mm-hmm. And this passion project resulted in her 6th Oscar nomination, this time for Best Actress. Which brings us right back to that central tension of her career. During the awards campaign for Albert Nobbs, she was inevitably asked about her lack of an Oscar win. And her response is really illuminating about her whole philosophy.
What did she say?
She said she was astounded that people fixated on the winning part. She framed the nomination itself as the victory. She said, basically, if you just do the simple math, the amount of movies made every year, and then you're 1 of 5 nominees, how could you possibly think of yourself as a loser? For her, the validation is clearly in the work itself, and the recognition of that work by her peers, not necessarily the final ballot result.
That's a powerful perspective. That internal philosophy must have been tested again with the massive critical success of The Wife in 2018.
Oh, for sure. The Wife brought her just widespread critical acclaim for her incredibly nuanced portrayal of Joan Castleman, a woman forced to reckon with decades spent supporting her famous Nobel Prize-winning husband. This was another subtle, deeply felt performance, one that really seemed destined finally to break that Oscar drought. Everyone thought this was it.
This role earned her her 7th Academy Award nomination. And we see that generational artistic connection again. Her own daughter, Annie Stark, played the younger version of her character, Joan, which must have added a beautiful parallel between their lives and the art. But of course, despite being the critical frontrunner, she lost again to Olivia Colman for The Favorite.
7 nominations, no wins. But if you want the single most perfect symbol of her career contradictions, the ability to be both lauded and criticized for the exact same choice, you absolutely have to look at her 8th nomination in 2020.
Hillbilly Elegy, where she played Mama, the matriarch, a role that demanded extreme character transformation and that raw, high-intensity acting she's known for.
Right. That performance received her 8th career Academy Award nomination for Supporting Actress, but... and this is the wild part. She simultaneously received a Razzie Award nomination for Worst Supporting Actress for the exact same role.
Wait, really? An Oscar nom and a Razzie nom for the same performance?
For the exact same performance, making her only the 3rd performer in history to achieve that bizarre, polarizing dual recognition, the highest praise and the lowest scorn, literally, for the same work.
What does that even tell us about her late career choices?
I think it tells us she remains a profound, utterly fearless risk taker. Her job, as she sees it, is to inhabit the character fully, often leaning into the kind of dramatic intensity that naturally divides critics. The fact that the same role can be seen as brilliant by one voting body and, well, awful by another, just shows she's prioritizing the complexity of the character over playing it safe or aiming for consensus. She refuses to just fade into polite and non-controversial roles.
That persistence definitely continues into her current work.
Yeah.
Hasn't retreated to easy paychecks at all. For season 2 of the Apple TV Plus thriller Tehran, she took on a pretty formidable challenge.
She actually learned to speak Persian for the role, Farsi. Yeah. That is the ultimate sign of her immersive dedication, isn't it? She's an actress with 5 decades of experience, and she's still dedicating herself to mastering an entirely new language for a cable television role. And her upcoming projects reflect this variety and commitment, too. Starring in the WWII drama, The New Look, joining the super high-profile 3rd Knives Out sequel, Wake Up Dead Man.
And we saw the intensity of her professional life recently collide with her health, unfortunately. She had to delay production on the Knives Out sequel after contracting both COVID-19 and RSV simultaneously.
Yet she's still scheduled for the film adaptation of The Hunger Games, Sunrise on the Reaping. Her commitment to performance seems absolutely unflagging. So now that we've traced the trajectory of her career, let's try to maybe nail down the Glenn Close signature. She is consistently described as extraordinarily versatile with an immersive style.
What defines that approach for her? Is it like method acting or something more personal?
Well, while she's obviously academically trained and does extensive research, she's actually cautious about relying purely on technicality. She argues that good acting is fundamentally like being a magician. She said her aim is to make people believe, because it's only when they believe that they are moved. She feels if she leans too heavily on the technical process, the audience might be left cold, intellectually understanding, but not emotionally connected. Her ultimate goal is emotional transport for the viewer.
And yet, Christopher Hampton, who worked with her on both Dangerous Liaisons and Sunset Boulevard, praised her ability to convey this immense sense of strength and intelligence in her roles. Even when she's playing someone vulnerable, you feel that profound internal control underneath.
That control is absolutely crucial because it makes the eventual breakdown or the eventual malice so much more terrifying when it comes. She has achieved legendary status largely by turning toward the dark side, by mastering the antagonist. Her Alex Forrest is ranked number 7 on the AFI's 100 Heroes and Villains list. And there is that stunning observation from the New York Times, which captured the essence of her screen power perfectly.
Which one was that? Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
There is no actor, dead or alive, as scary as a smiling Glenn Close.
Exactly. That quote just encapsulates the tension, the perceived warmth or control that hides the profound, often carefully managed violence or intensity beneath. She owns the antagonist space like almost no one else, precisely because she projects intelligence and sometimes vulnerability first, making the turn to villainy feel earned and terrifyingly realistic.
Okay, moving beyond performance for a moment, her legacy is also fundamentally defined by her fierce activism, especially in mental health advocacy. This connects right back, doesn't it, to the profound need she maybe had, coming out of the MRA, to control her own narrative and champion others who are often stigmatized.
This is perhaps her most significant work offstage, arguably. She is the founder and chairperson of Bring Change to Mind, a major national campaign dedicated to eradicating the stigma and discrimination surrounding mental illness. And this movement was deeply personal for her, inspired directly by her younger sister, Jessie, who lives with bipolar disorder, and also her nephew, who lives with schizoaffective disorder.
And she didn't just, you know, donate money or lend her name, which some celebrities do. She became the public face of the issue, even sharing highly personal details to drive awareness. In 2010, she had her own DNA sequenced publicly.
Yes. To raise awareness about her family's history of mental illness, that demonstrated immense courage and vulnerability, putting her own family's struggles out there.
And her advocacy efforts resulted in massive, tangible legislative change. That's the really impressive part. In 2013, she addressed the White House and successfully lobbied for the passage of the Excellence in Mental Health Act.
That's right. And this bill was eventually signed into law by President Obama in 2014, and it provided a substantial $1.1 billion in funding to strengthen the community mental health care system in the U.S.
That achievement really transforms her status from just a celebrity philanthropist to a major legislative force. She took the trauma, perhaps, of her restrictive childhood, that feeling of being controlled and silenced, and channeled it into this powerful public platform dedicated to helping others speak and be heard without shame.
Absolutely. And her political stance aligns with this focus on rights and personal freedom. She's a staunch advocate for women's rights and same-sex marriage, receiving a GL Aid Media Award back in 2002. Her political donations have largely supported Democratic politicians like Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama, and she has been publicly critical of political figures who she feels undermine those values.
Just to round out the picture a little, a few final personal quirks. She's the president of her own production company, Trillium Productions. She also indulged her love for dogs by co-founding Fetch Dog, a dog accessories catalog and website.
Yeah, Fetch Dog, which she eventually sold in 2012. And she is a passionate, lifelong New York Mets fan. Apparently, she sung the national anthem at Shea Stadium in Citi Field numerous times since way back in 1986. That sense of commitment and loyalty just seems to define her relationships, whether it's to a baseball team or her alma mater.
And finally, partly due to her campy, intense, and often wonderfully over-the-top antagonist roles on both stage and screen, think Cruella, think Norma Desmond, she's also widely recognized as a gay icon, proving that embracing her full intensity led to cultural acceptance and influence far beyond traditional industry metrics.
Which Time magazine affirmed, really, by naming her one of the 100 most influential people in the world back in 2019. Hashtag tag outro. So, as we close this deep dive, what does Glenn Close's remarkable and, yes, paradoxical career, when you view it in its totality, what does it ultimately teach us, do you think?
Well, I think it shows us that extreme artistic expression is often forged in personal struggle. We trace that explosion of professional intensity, that absolute drive to conquer every medium, directly back to the stifling, controlled environment of the MRA cult she endured. And her subsequent conscious decision to pivot away from safe roles into iconic villainy fundamentally redefined cinematic antagonism for a whole generation.
And we really can't ignore the tension created by the Oscars, can we? She's achieved the Triple Crown nomination, she has the Tonys, the Emmys, the Golden Globes. And yet she still holds that unwanted record. But because of her perspective that the work is the reward, that paradox doesn't seem to define failure for her. It defines persistence.
That quote really is the key, isn't it? How could you possibly think of yourself as a loser?
Exactly. And when we examine her late career dedication, spending 2 decades to bring Albert Nobbs to the screen just to stimulate conversation, teaching herself Persian for a supporting role in a TV thriller, it demonstrates that for an actor of her stature, the pursuit of complex artistic truth in the performance itself profoundly outweighs the public external validation of an award. The process really is the victory for her.
So the final provocative thought we want to leave you with today is this. What is Glenn Close's persistent and decades-long push for roles that challenge audiences, roles that stimulate discussion, even as she continues to accumulate nominations without wins for those same roles? What does that tell us about the true definition of a successful artistic life? Is success measured solely by the gold statue on the mantelpiece? Or is it measured by the unflagging intensity required simply to keep seeking and articulating the difficult, complex truths hidden within the material itself?
Something to definitely mull over until our next deep dive.
We'll see you next time.
Trust and Will is an online estate planning service. Visit trustandwill.com for details.
Ooh, Trust and Will.
My dad and I were always close, but some things we just didn't talk about, like his will. After he was gone, we found out he didn't have one, and it created a lot of stress during a time of grief.
Creating a will can be hard to think about, but avoiding it can lead to greater difficulty for the people you love. That's why Trust and Will makes estate planning simple. Create a will online in as little as 30 minutes.
Now, I have a will in place to make sure my loved ones are protected. With Trust and Will, it was easy and affordable. And I got peace of mind knowing my wishes are clear.
Trust and Will.
Get 20% off when you visit trustandwill.com/future. That's trustandwill.com/future to get 20% off. trustandwill.com/future.
Planet Fitness has everything you need to get stronger just around the corner, so you can give everything you've got. Whether you want to crush a few reps before class with our expanded strength equipment or sweat it out on your way home from work, with over 2,800 locations, there's a Planet Fitness close to you, and most are open 24 hours. Join the club today and save $28 or more when you join for $1 down, $15 a month. Cancel anytime. Deal ends January 30th. Are you coming? Planet Fitness. We're all strong on this planet. See club for details.